So in-house, we have this idea that this isn't going to go right. This is too jarring a change. It needs to be rolled out slowly. We need to warm people up to this. And Mark is just firmly committed. We're just going to do this. We're just going to launch. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. Rishi Sanghvi. We pushed the product in the dead of night. We were really excited. We were celebrating, and then the next morning we woke up to all this pushback. I had written this blog post, Facebook gets a facelift. Katie Gemender. We wrote a little letter, and at the bottom of it we put a button, and the button said, awesome. Not like okay, it was awesome. That's just rude. I wish I had a screenshot of that. Oh, man. And that was it. You landed on Facebook and you got the feature. We gave you no choice. And not a great explanation. And it scared people. Jeff Rothschild. People were rattled because it just seemed like it was exposing information that hadn't been visible before. In fact, that wasn't the case. Everything shown in newsfeed was something people put on the site that would have been visible to everyone if they had gone and visited that profile. Rishi Sanghvi. Users were revolting. They were threatening to boycott the product. They felt that they had been violated and that their privacy had been violated. There were students organizing petitions. People had lined up outside the office. We hired a security guard. Katie Gemender. There were camera crews outside. There were protests. Bring back the old Facebook. Everyone hated it. Jeff Rothschild. There was such a violent reaction to it. We had people marching on the office. A Facebook group was organized protesting newsfeed, and inside of 2 days, a million people joined. Rishi Sanghvi. There was another group that was about how Rishi is the devil because I had written that blog post. Max Kelly. The user base fought it every step of the way and would pound us. Pound customer service and say, this is fucked up. This is terrible. Ezra Callahan. We're getting emails from relatives and friends. They're like, what did you do? This is terrible. Change it back. Katie Gemender. We were sitting in the office and the protests were going on outside and it was, do we roll it back? Do we roll it back? Rishi Sanghvi. Now, under usual circumstances, if about 10% of your user base starts to boycott the product, you would shut it down. But we saw a very unusual pattern emerge. Max Kelly. Even the same people who were telling us that this is terrible, we'd look at their user stream and be like, you're fucking using it constantly. What are you talking about? Rishi Sanghvi. Despite the fact that there were these revolts and these petitions, people were lined up outside the office, they were digging the product. They were actually using it. And they were using it twice as much as before newsfeed. Ezra Callahan. It was just an emotionally devastating few days for everyone at the company, especially for the set of people who had been waving their arms saying, don't do this, because they feel like, this is exactly what we told you was going to happen. Rishi Sanghvi. Mark was on his very first press tour on the East Coast, and the rest of us were in the Palo Alto office dealing with this and looking at these logs and seeing the engagement and trying to communicate that it's actually working and to just try a few things before we chose to shut it down. Katie Gemender. We had to push some privacy features right away to quell the storm. Rishi Sanghvi. We asked everyone to give us 24 hours. Katie Gemender. We built this janky privacy audio mixer with these little slider bars where you could turn things on and off. It was beautifully designed. It looked gorgeous, but it was irrelevant. Jeff Rothschild. I don't think anyone ever used it. Ezra Callahan. But it gets added, and eventually the immediate reaction subsides, and people realize that the news feed is exactly what they wanted. This feature is exactly right. This just made Facebook 1,000 times more useful. Katie Gemender. Like photos. Newsfeed was just, boom, a major change in the product, and one of those sea changes that just leveled it up. Jeff Rothschild. Our usage just skyrocketed on the launch of Newsfeed. About the same time, we also opened the site up to people who didn't have a .edu address. Ezra Callahan. Once it opens to the public, it's becoming clear that Facebook is on its way to becoming the directory of all the people in the world. Jeff Rothschild. Those two things together, that was the inflection point where Facebook became a massively used product. Prior to that, we were a niche product for high school and college students. Mark Zuckerberg. Domination. Ruchi Sanghvi. Domination was a big mantra of Facebook back in the day. Max Kelly. I remember company meetings where we were chanting, dominate! Ezra Callahan. We had company parties all the time, and for a period in 2005, all Mark's toasts at the company parties would end with, domination! Mark Zuckerberg. Domination. Max Kelly. I especially remember the meeting where we tore up the Yahoo offer. Mark Pincus. In 2006, Yahoo offered Facebook $1.2 billion, I think it was. And it seemed like a breathtaking offer at the time, and it was difficult to imagine them not taking it. Everyone had seen Napster flame out, Friendster flame out, MySpace flame out. So to be a company with no revenues, and a credible company offers $1.2 billion, and to say no to that? You have to have a lot of respect to founders that say no to these offers. Dustin Moskovitz. I was sure the product would suffer in a big way if Yahoo bought us, and Sean was telling me that 90% of all mergers end in failure. Mark Pincus. Luckily for Zuck and history, Yahoo's stock went down, and they wouldn't change the offer. They said that the offer is a fixed number of shares, and so the offer dropped to like 800 million. And I think probably emotionally, Zuck didn't want to do it, and it gave him a clear out. If Yahoo had said, no problem, we'll back that up with cash or stock to make it 1.2 billion, it might have been a lot harder for Zuck to say no. And maybe Facebook would be a little division of Yahoo today. Max Kelly. We literally tore the Yahoo offer up and stomped on it as a company. We were like, fuck those guys, we are going to own them. That was some malice-ass bullshit. Mark Zuckerberg. Domination. Kate Laws. He had kind of an ironic way of saying it. It wasn't a totally flat, scary domination. It was funny. It was only when you think about a much bigger scale of things that you're like, are people aware that their interactions are being architected by a group of people who have a certain set of ideas about how the world works and what's good? Ezra Callahan. How much was the direction of the Internet influenced by the perspective of 19, 20, 21-year-old well-off white boys? That's a real question that sociologists will be studying forever. Kate Laws. I don't think most people really think about the impact that the values of a few people now have on everyone. Stephen Johnson. I think there's legitimate debate about this. Facebook has certainly contributed to some echo chamber problems and political polarization problems, but I spent a lot of time arguing that the Internet is less responsible for that than people think. Mark Pincus. Maybe I'm too close to it all, but I think that when you pull the camera back, none of us really matter that much. I think the Internet is following a path to where the Internet wants to go. We're all trying to figure out what consumers want. And if what people want is this massive echo chamber and this vain world of likes, someone is going to give it to them. And they're going to be the one who wins, and the ones who don't, won't. Steve Jobs. I don't see anybody other than Facebook out there. They're dominating. Mark Pincus. So I don't exactly think that a bunch of college boys shaped the Internet. I just think they got there first. Mark Zuckerberg. Domination. Ezra Callahan. So it's not until we have a full-time general counsel on board who finally says, Mark, for the love of God, you cannot use the word domination anymore. That he stops. Sean Parker. Once you are dominant, then suddenly it becomes an anti-competitive term. Stephen Johnson. It took the internet 30 years to get to 1 billion users. It took Facebook 10 years to get to 1 billion users. The crucial thing about Facebook is that it's not a service or an app. It's a fundamental platform on the same scale as the internet itself. Steve Jobs. I admire Mark Zuckerberg. I only know him a little bit, but I admire him for not selling out, for wanting to make a company. I admire that a lot. Purple People Eater. Apple, the company that cannibalizes itself. Only 3 years after reviving Apple on the back of the iPod, Steve Jobs decides to make it obsolete. As an Atari alumnus, Jobs knows firsthand the danger of trying to milk a hot product for all it is worth. He knows that somebody at some point will unseat Apple's iPod monopoly with an MP3 player that can also place a phone call. Thus, Jobs concludes, Apple has to act first. So he sets up a skunk works, Project Purple. Then, to make sure that the phone of the future project has the proper urgency, Jobs divides Purple into two groups and pits them against each other. P1 is quarterbacked by Tony Fadell, the hardware hero who had changed Apple's fortunes with the iPod. P2 is led by Scott Forstall, a software whiz from Apple's Macintosh team. Will the new Apple phone be a tiny Macintosh or a supersized iPod? In the end, Jobs chooses Forstall's version, a tiny Macintosh, and uses the iPhone's debut to send a message to Fadell. Jobs disses Fadell from the stage, surreptitiously, but before an audience of millions. Fadell's days at Apple are numbered. Phil Schiller. Apple had been known for years for being the creator of the Mac computer, and it was great, but it had a small market share. And then we had a big hit called the iPod, and this really changed everybody's view both inside and outside the company. People started asking, well, if you can have a big hit with the iPod, what else can you do? And so we were searching for what to do after the iPod that would make sense. Scott Forstall. And one thought was a tablet. Phil Schiller. People were suggesting every idea. Make a camera, make a car, crazy stuff. Scott Forstall. And we settled on this idea of a beautiful tablet, without a keyboard, without a hinge. John Rubinstein. But the technology just wasn't there yet. Different combinations of horsepower, battery life, display technology. None of those worked for a tablet yet. But we'd acquired the technology for doing multi-touch, so we could develop that. Multi-touch is the ability to directly interact with your screen and be able to pinch and zoom and drag and all those kind of things. Steve Jobs. I had this idea of being able to get rid of the keyboard and type on a multi-touch glass display, so I asked our folks if we could come up with a multi-touch display that I could rest my hands on and actually type on. Phil Schiller. We thought that if you wanted to type really fast, you were going to be touching that surface with more than one finger. At the time, no one had really done anything with multi-touch, and we knew that was really important. Scott Forstall. So we started building prototypes and demos to see if we could build a tablet. That was 2003. Steve Jobs. And about 6 months later, they called me in and showed me this prototype display. And it was amazing. Nitin Ganatra. There was just this enormous contraption that was created partly by the Mac hardware team. So what we actually had was this tablet-looking device with a big fat cable that connected it to a Macintosh. Scott Forstall. We were asking ourselves, could we use the technology that we were prototyping for this tablet to build a phone? Tony Fadell. Mobile phones were coming on strong. Nitin Ganatra. But all of the technical advancements around phones were happening somewhere other than Silicon Valley. All the interesting work was either in Finland or in Japan or in Canada. There was nothing in the U.S., much less in Silicon Valley. Scott Forstall. We all hated our phones. We had flip phones at the time. Nitin Ganatra. And every single one of them to a T is just dog shit. We hold up our phones and show each other the latest and greatest and look at them. This is the latest and greatest because it has 256 colors on it? We're talking about the early 2000s. This is considered state of the art? Even though in computing this problem was tackled 20 years before? How backward is that? I would talk to Scott about this a fair bit, saying, when are we going to do a phone? Scott Forstall. And so we prototyped a thing which I will never forget. We took that tablet and built a small scrolling list. Now, on a tablet, we were doing pinch and zoom and scrolls and all these things, and we wanted it to fit in the pocket. So we built a small corner of it as a list of contacts. Nitin Ganatra. All the pixels and everything were sort of shoved down into a corner to more accurately reflect what a phone's form factor would actually look like. Scott Forstall. And you'd sit there and you'd scroll this list of contacts, and you could tap on that contact. It would slide over and show you the contact information, and you could tap on the phone number and it would say, calling. It wasn't calling, but it would say it was calling, and it was just amazing. Steve Jobs. And when I saw the rubber band inertial scrolling and a few of the other things, I thought, my God, we can build a phone out of this. John Rubinstein. Because the key to a phone is, can you get through the names quickly? Right? One of the big issues with the iPod was, how the hell do you find the song that you want to play? So if you were not going to have a scroll wheel on the iPhone, then you needed an equivalent user interface paradigm to get to who you wanted to call. Nitin Ganatra. Even though it was this big, clunky contraption and things didn't quite work right, you could see that it was far and away better than the piece of trash that you had in your pocket. Scott Forstall. We realized that a touch screen that could fit in your pocket would work perfectly as one of these phones. Phil Schiller. So the combination of what should come after the iPod and having this multi-touch glass technology came together around the same time to give us this vision. Scott Forstall. The whole illusion that we were trying to create was that your fingers were literally reaching through the screen to the content that you saw behind it. Nitin Ganatra. If you looked at that UI, it was like comparing heaven and earth. That's exactly how I felt, and how everyone on our team felt, too. Scott Forstall. So we shelved the idea of the tablet for years, and in 2004 we switched over to building what became the iPhone. Ron Johnson. The phone is a product everyone uses, like music, right? Steve always wanted to do things that had a big market. Nitin Ganatra. Purple was the code name for the software stack that would become the iPhone. And to get the kind of UI we wanted, it was understood that this project was going to be really ambitious. But there was also an understanding that it was going to be quite a long period of time before we could actually have it out there. Scott Forstall. Steve knew that there were going to be a lot of people that were going to have to be involved. A lot of groups. So he put different people in charge of each of the groups. I was put in charge of all of the software. So I started and built a team. Andy Grignon. And since Tony was making hardware, it landed in Fidel's kind of purview. Nitin Ganatra. The iPod team felt like it was their right to develop the next embedded hardware product that Apple has. They already had a phenomenal success with the iPod. They had delivered this thing in a very short amount of time, and it was already sort of seen as the future of Apple, even at that point. So, of course, the group that is going to develop the next thing that fits in your pocket is going to be the iPod group. Tony Fidel. So first it was the iPod, then it was the iPod with music syncing, then it became the iPod with music and photos syncing, then it became the iPod with the iTunes music store so you did not have to rip anymore, then it worked with videos, then it became the iPod with games and videos and all the other stuff, so that was great. And then it was the iPod with games and downloadable apps or downloadable games, so now let's make it a phone. Nitin Ganatra. In early 2005, there was a meeting. Steve Jobs did most of the talking. Phil Schiller was there and Tony Fadell, and then a lot of leadership from the Purple side and John Rubinstein as well. So we all pile into this room and Steve starts talking about how we have got this fantastic plan and we've got this great UI, but we don't have time to wait. Andy Hertzfeld. It was clear that iPods were going to disappear within 5 years because smartphones were going to subsume them. Guy Barnahum. It was a panic by Steve Jobs that Nokia and Motorola would kill iPod. Phil Schiller. Because we realized that if anything were ever to challenge the idea that you have all your entertainment in your pocket, your movies, your photos, your music, it would be the cell phone. Nitin Ganatra. At this point, almost on cue, Tony, who is sitting at the center of a sort of longish table, starts talking about a contingency plan for something that's going to bridge between now and when we can actually ship Purple. That is when the designations P1 and P2 were created. Tony Fadell. P1 was the iPod Plus phone, the iPod phone. It had a small screen and a wheel and a cell phone built into it. Nitin Ganatra. P1 was ultimately a way to sort of unseat what Tony saw as being an unrealistic plan to begin with, which was to fit an OS X-based software stack onto iPhone hardware. P1 was Tony's attempt to basically own the iPhone. Andy Grignon. P2 was this purely experimental concept. Can we ship OS X on a phone? Is it possible? If we strip it back? P2 was the more radical design. Nitin Ganatra. Tony thought the P2 team was never really capable of shipping the iPhone software to begin with. And once the P1 came out in record time, it was going to be understood that P2 was a science project. Andy Grignon. P2 was bloated. It was huge. It didn't work. Mac OS was built for heavy iron. P2 required an entirely new piece of silicon because of Mac OS. This was Forstall's attempt to insert himself into the phone project, right? Nitin Ganatra. My whole goal at the time was to make it so that any functionality was demoed on P2 before it demoed in P1, because I want to start chipping away at this perception that this thing is a science project and that it's never going to ship. We definitely felt like we were the underdogs. One of the things that internally we used as a rallying point was, we need to demonstrate this functionality before the P1 team can. And God damn it if that didn't work to motivate us. Scott Forstall. They were there at night. They were there on weekends. Nitin Ganatra. We lost Christmas vacation time, Thanksgiving time, holidays, weekends, nights, things like that. The first breakthrough was just actually seeing the full stack running on something that was not a Macintosh. The first version of the iPhone hardware was actually this thing where there were three different logic boards that were all separate and all connected up with cables. And on one end there was a little phone display, but it still took up literally two-thirds of a conference table. But the thing that was running on the display was the actual iPhone software. And it was actually able to send and receive text messages, real SMS messages, going through the software stack, through this prototype hardware, and then back up to another phone. For me, that was sort of the first big, oh my God, we're not completely off in the weeds here moment. We're actually going to be able to make this thing work. Matt Rogers. We were working on something else, a click wheel-based solution. We were basically fusing a phone with an iPod. I was deep in the lab making this thing happen, and Tony was selling it to Steve. Every other week, Tony would take what we were doing and show it to Steve. And Steve would say, "This is shit, this is shit, this is shit, this is good, fix that." Tony Fadell. It was about 4 or 5 months of research, but halfway through, everybody knew it wasn't working. But Steve didn't want us to give up, so we kept working on it, and getting more and more dejected. Andy Grignon. We actually built a working iPod phone, several hundred of them, actually. It was a little wider, but still thinner than the iPods at the time. You would go into phone mode from player mode, and the controls changed over to the rotary dial interface. Ron Johnson. It was a familiar interface that was beloved. Everyone understood how to use the scroll wheel, and we could bring it out at like $400. To do the touch phone would be $600 or $700. So there was a long debate. There was a choice we had to make. We had to pick one, and I'm pretty sure everyone was leaning toward the iPod phone. But Steve always leaned toward the future. Steve always leaned to the most innovative. I remember Steve saying, "If we don't do this all-display phone, someone else might do it first." And the all-display phone is the big idea. Guy Barnahome. I'm not sure if it's a real memory or not, but in my imagination, in my kind of mythical memory, there was a meeting where Steve said, "What is this thing that we're building?" And Steve basically was looking at people and asking a rhetorical question. And he answered it. "We're building software. This thing that we're building is software. Software is pixels. And because it's pixels, it has to be all screen." Matt Rogers. We spent a good 3 or 4 months on that initial prototype that Tony presented to Steve, and we ended up killing it because it wasn't good enough. You can see why Steve made the call. "We can do better, guys." The iPod phone thing didn't have apps. It was kind of music plus phone. OS X brings in all these other experiences. Guy Barnahome. Before that, it was the land of confusion. It's all kinds of creatures that were born in sin, and there were several of them that we all want to forget. There's no value in going and digging and getting embarrassed by these weird things that we did before the decision to go all touch. Weird amalgamations, incremental design away from iPod, literally a phone with a wheel, right? Or a phone that was half touch surface, half screen. Those were exercises before the big insight, the big bombshell. The bombshell that Steve kind of laid on people was that it has to be all screen. So once you say that it's all screen, it's obvious. The shape is obvious. Phil Schiller. It's rounded corners, a rectangular shape, a full glass face with the black screen and the black area around the screen just seen as one. Christopher Stringer. You want to create the simplest, purest manifestation of what the object can be. Andy Grignon. So Tony, even though he delivered the hugely successful iPod business, had lost control. Tony was still on the hook to build the actual hardware, but Forstall had won the software war. And so now Tony was building Forstall's hardware, which chapped him to no end. Tony Fadell. The confidentiality started driving a wedge between the teams, and then it was used as a tool. Matt Rogers. I was part of the hardware team responsible for building the product, and there was a separate team at Apple led by Scott Forstall that was building the software, and we would meet at some kind of neutral territory to make sure things got together. Andy Grignon. Scott knew that his path to world domination was holding that UI under lock and key. Scott Forstall. On the front door of the purple dorm, we put up a sign that said, "Fight Club," because the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. And the first rule about the purple project is you do not talk about that outside of those doors. Andy Grignon. This is when Steve's leadership and management style started to permeate the company. Tony and Forstall started to adopt Steve's mannerisms and persona because it was a pressure cooker. But also you emulate what works, right? And so everyone started screaming at each other. It became just like the thing to do, fly off the fucking handle. Tony Fidel. It became, your team can't see the apps, your team can't touch any of this stuff. We had to create a whole other operating system for diagnostics and manufacture. Andy Grignon. An app that my team had written called Skankphone is what most of the people involved on the project could actually use. It was like blue buttons on a red background. It was just awful to look at. We did it on purpose. It was supposed to be hideous. Tony Fidel. Then Steve and Scott would say, you can't even show the devices to your people. And my engineers were saying, we need to use these things. We need to try them. Because we have to make phone calls in the wild. We have to start testing cell phone networks. We have to test all kinds of different things. It was driving a wedge. Matt Rogers. Imagine trying to get a product that has never been done before, done in record time, and yet you were not working with the guys that were your counterparts. We went from there basically to the product we know today, the product that we ended up shipping. At the time, it was 2 years out. It was a monumental effort around the company. It was nuts. Andy Grignon. The iPhone is a product that by all accounts should never have succeeded. There wasn't a single stable proven element in the entire stack. We'd never made a phone before. Now granted, lots of people have been building phones, so what do? The very first thing is you start to go shop for people who know how to do this. Well, Steve, being crazy, but also being the genius that he was, told us we were not allowed to hire people who knew how to build phones. It was not because he was being a dick. Actually, he was a little bit, but he wanted us to invent the knowledge ourselves. Scott Forstall. There were a number of challenges, one of which was that everything we dealt with before was based on a mouse and keyboard, so we had to rethink everything. Every single part of the device had to be rethought for doing touch. So we started with a brand new user interface, instead of something that was existing. Andy Grignon. Then product design. Johnny Ives guys would come out with a model and say, we're going to make it look like this. Oh, it doesn't have any buttons? Yes, so we need to invent a keyboard? All right. We'll just add that to the list, right? Nitin Ganatra. One of the things that terrified me was, how the heck are we going to make a virtual keyboard work anywhere near as well as a physical keyboard? Scott Forstall. If you look back to 2005 when the engineering team started on this, smartphones all had physical keyboards. The most popular at the time was probably the BlackBerry, and it had a physical keyboard. And many people at the time thought we were actually crazy to try to build something without any form of a physical keyboard. Not a slide-out one, not one on the front screen, nothing. And so it was a science project for us to be able to create an on-screen touch keyboard that could work really well and then get out of the way when you weren't using it. Nitin Ganatra. We actually had sort of a hack contest that Scott Forstall put together where anybody who was an engineer on the iPhone software development team could go off and create their own version of what a virtual keyboard should be and how it should work. Andy Hertzfeld. Steve Jobs himself told me he thought a lot about General Magic while he was working on the iPhone. And reading between the lines, I think he was mainly talking about the projected keyboard. That's the main breakthrough of the iPhone, to not have the keyboard. But because he had used the General Magic devices, he knew that you can do the projected keyboard effectively. It turns out that the screen resolution of the original iPhone was identical to the General Magic devices. Andy Grignon. But again, going back to why this thing shouldn't have succeeded, let's start from the bottom. We're using a chip that's never been tested before. It's a brand new part, and Samsung has made lots of chips before, but they've never made one with the configuration and the random requirements that we had. So the chip is not stable. We don't have a reference design for a phone, so we had to make that. So now we've got a piece of hardware we think we can make work, but we're using a finger to interface with a product. We've never done that before. How do we do that? And by the way, it's supposed to work with five fingers at a minimum. So now, all of a sudden, we were now increasing the complexity and craziness of this product. Now we get into the software space. We're now putting an operating system that to date has only run on a different class of processor, an Intel processor, and rebuilding the software for ARM. This whole other instruction set, which is completely different. That's crazy. Nitin Ganatra. Seeing our software run on the very first iPhone, the M68 hardware, that was the second breakthrough. Andy Grignon. Everything had code names, so P2 was the program name, and M68 was the name of the actual hardware, the actual thing. Tony Fidel. The original iPod was called P68, and we were in the M series now, so I thought, let's just name it M68, because hopefully it's as good as the regular P68. Andy Grignon. And we used to send people over to China with empty suitcases. They would take units off the factory line over at Foxconn and turn around. Just fly there, pick them up, and fly them back. That way nothing could get lost in shipping. We'd pay the border guards off, or whatever the fuck, but that's how we'd ensure that the units got back safely and quickly without going through all this mumbo-jumbo. And we had gotten our very first units back. You're looking at it like, this is my baby. This is why we've been working so fucking hard. You're seeing a thing light up the first time and you're like, oh, that's fucking baller. Nitin Ganatra. It was another one of these holy shit, we actually did it moments. It actually works, and it actually works a little bit better in some ways than we were anticipating. Yes, it was just amazing. Andy Grignon. And we were sitting around in the hallways. It was our very first time actually using a fully completed thing, and it was just a moment of silence. We were all sitting there playing with it, right? It was the very first time you could hold the thing in your hand, and it was like, oh, that's pretty fucking cool. And of course, you start doing the pinch. You start to do all this multi-touch stuff, right? Guy Barnahum. My team was worried. They came to me saying, the fucker doesn't dial well. It's the worst phone I've ever used. I told them, look, guys, you're missing the whole point. We're not making a phone. We're making a laptop killer. That's what we're making here, right? I told them, Nokia is about connecting people. What do? We separate people. We're Americans. We want to be alone. We don't want to be connecting to other people. Dialing people is not the killer app for this thing. Andy Grignon. So we're sitting there. We're browsing. We're playing with Safari. And I was like, I wonder what's the first thing that people are going to do. They're going to browse porn. So I went to this porn site, Fubies.com, which was just a booby site, nothing big. But I was like, I'm the first guy to surf porn on an iPhone. I was like, yes! Guy Barnahum. I told them, the killer app for this thing is browsing the web and checking email. And if someone is going to call me, I don't give a fuck about that. And after that, they relaxed. They were like, okay, I get it. Andy Grignon. It still had a lot of flaws. You still look at your baby with a very critical eye, right? Like, oh, it doesn't do this. It's kind of fucked up. This shit is totally broke. It's all that kind of stuff, right? None of us had really let the idea sink in that this was the next gigantic hit for Apple. Nitin Ganatra. The big deadline that we had was the January 2007 announcement at Macworld. There was going to be a long and very extensive demo that was going to be done by Steve. We probably first learned about this in October 2006, and it was, holy crap, we are going to be demoing this thing in January. Matt Rogers. Apple is a unique place. Apple is tens of thousands of people, and they work on 5 products. And those products are awesome. And every engineer, every designer, every product manager knows that everything must be awesome. When you set a schedule, you don't miss a schedule. There are thousands of people depending on it. Andy Grignon. And we had this impossible deadline just to hit the announcement. Nitin Ganatra. There was going to be this demo of the deep functionality of the iPhone, and at the very end, this grand finale where Steve then goes back and does this multi-step task involving numerous applications to actually show both that, hey, this thing actually can have value, and that this isn't just smoke and mirrors, that this is the real deal. Christopher Stringer. This broke new ground. It was more than a phone. Smartphones existed, but they were more like tiny little computers. Nitin Ganatra. So it was understood that Steve was actually going to try to use this thing like a normal user would. And he's going to do it in January, and he's going to do it up on stage in front of the whole world to see. We were just terrified. Because it's one thing to write software that works in isolation, but to actually have something that works integrated with a lot of other components, that's when a whole other class of bugs make themselves known. Holy crap. Nobody was going home for vacation. Nobody's going home for Thanksgiving. In fact, what are you doing this weekend? Matt Rogers. And the previous 4 weeks were insane. I cannot even describe it. Myself and a team of about 25 were over in China, basically hand-building them from scratch. We literally were working 24/7 to make sure that those first 200 or 300 units were perfect. Andy Grignon. These were the show phones, right? Johnny and Steve literally graded with a jeweler's loop and white gloves every single phone. They're looking for the most minute imperfections. And then they grade them. The best are double A. If we were to make it today, that's what we would want. Now, right before these phones go to Moscone Center, it's time to flash that new software that has all the fixes on them, right? And so we bless the build. Everything is good. And someone goes to install the software on our units, the show units, and he's got a gang programmer so you can burn the software into 8 phones at a time. He starts off with the double A's. And so, when we put new software down, the phone thought that we were trying to do something subversive. It thought it was being tampered with, and it lit the fuse. The chip has a security feature which lights a piece of metal up deep in the processor for the baseband. And when that's gone, the phone is dead. We turned these phones into bricks. We had burned up our best units for the show. On the weekend before, we're starting to go through the run-through. I should have gotten fired on the spot for that. So we ultimately fixed that problem. The phones are there. Then we did the launch. Eddie Q. It was the only event I took my wife and kids to because, as I told them, in your lifetime, this might be the biggest thing ever. Because you could feel it. You just knew this was huge. The iPhone was the culmination of everything for Steve. Andy Hertzfeld. It was kind of a privileged ticket to be there. And Steve really is a bit nuts about levels of privilege at events. He really cared about who he invited to that and who we didn't. And so I was excited to go. Phil Schiller. People have been waiting so long and were so excited about this upcoming event at Macworld. The energy was amazing. Electric, I would call it. Andy Grignon. Except there wasn't a completed anything. And so a couple of things could happen. The phone could crash. Hard crash. So you would see the Apple logo and it shits the bed. And you know it's rebooting from scratch. That's a bad one. That happened. But largely what happened is you would use all the memory and there was this part of the operating system which would shoot an app in the head to free up memory, right? Mail was a particularly poor performer in that respect. Or for web pages, same thing. The OS would be like, you know that one is using too much memory, and then it would just go away. You would see the app just disappear, right? Or more subtle things, the baseband, the chip that makes the actual phone calls would crash, and the signal strength would come and go, or whatever. But that would be very obvious to the audience watching the projected screen. We were just on pins and needles. We're like, what the fuck is going to go wrong? Nitin Ganatra, the most terrifying time is when your bits, the bits that you've actually worked on, are up on the big screen and Steve is interacting with them, because God help you if there's any kind of screw-up at all. Andy Grignon, you know, during the announcement, Steve sent a message to Tony. He deleted Tony. And that was the end of Tony. On stage. Nitin Ganatra, during the Macworld demo, in front of the whole entire world, Steve went and deleted Tony Fadell's name from the list of favorites within that phone app. Andy Grignon, he joked about it like, let's say there's somebody here who I don't want to talk to anymore. And then he scrolls through and he comes up to Tony's name. And I can just do one swipe, tap delete, and he's gone. People laughed about it, but everybody knew. Steve doesn't do things like that for fun. Steve was a complicated guy. Steve was, in many ways, diabolical. And Tony and Steve's relationship had grown increasingly rocky. Steve would just fly off the handle on random things, and Tony just had to take it. And by this point, Forstall and Tony had developed a full-on feud with each other. Tony Fadell, that demo script was created by Scott Forstall. Nitin Ganatra, now you could innocently look at it as, look, I can add things to favorites easily, and I can delete things that are no longer my favorites easily. But I think it was understood that Steve doesn't do these things by accident. Steve will run through these scripts dozens of times just on his own. It looks so fluid and natural up there, but the amount of preparation that goes into it is just staggering. Andy Grignon, we had outlined what was called the golden path, right? The path that Steve had to do each and every time. And if he didn't, the phone would crash because it was running out of memory or whatever. It was, if you opened this email before you opened that email, something would get corrupted, and we just couldn't figure out why. We'd eventually get to it, but we just don't know why then, right? But if Steve did it in this exact order, we're good. Just nobody breathe on it. Nitin Ganatra. We were sitting in the audience. We were in the third row, and Andy pulled out a flask, and there was this drinking game that happened, where every single time somebody's piece was shown on screen, and everything worked well, and Steve went on to the next thing, the flask got passed to the person who was largely responsible for those pieces working. Andy Grignon. So after each chunk, it was like, knock 'em back. I ended up doing 8 or 9 shots, and I was completely obliterated by the actual end. That's when it seems like a great idea to just finish the bottle, because you're like, oh, fuck, yes! It was a flawless demo. So we drank the rest of that bottle, then we went out and smoked a bowl, and then just got messed up for the rest of that day. Nitin Ganatra. Early on, there was a whisper campaign by BlackBerry and by Nokia, these other companies who already had phones out there, that was going around. Yes, the iPhone was really cool looking, but it's not a serious business device. But we understood that this is kind of how the business works. Guy Barnahum. I told my team, look, guys, look at Nokia. They're laughing at us. They're saying, that's not even a phone. That's a piece of crap. But they don't know what just happened to them. Nitin Ganatra. We were immediately drawing parallels to what happened to the Macintosh in the 80s. It was exactly what was being said about the Macintosh right when the Macintosh came out, too. Guy Barnahum. The first iPhone was just like the Mac. It was a fully owned, closed system. Steve was like, I don't want third-party apps on my perfect thing. Andy Grignon. Steve had made the edict. His reason was that the second we let some knucklehead app developer write some software, We take the risk that it crashes the phone. At the end of the day, you don't know what the fuck some developer who is coked up and on a bender is going to cook up. Guy Barnahum. And then Google came along and said, we're doing Android. So what's the difference? Android was going to allow people to download third-party apps. Steve Wozniak. The first iPhone did not have the App Store. Guy Barnahum. Steve panicked, and literally all of a sudden, everything clicks through his head, and he realizes that he was like a mile behind Google. Steve Wozniak. Openness is so important, and the App Store is a type of openness. It wasn't the original idea of the iPhone. Steve had to be convinced of it. Guy Barnahum. And so he went to Forrestal and told him, hey, Forrestal, we have to open up an ecosystem. And that's where Forrestal shined the second time after making the iPhone UI. He told him, I was working on it the whole time. So Forrestal had actually ignored Steve's verbatim order, and he worked on it in the basement and made it happen. You have to have balls of steel to do something like that. Guy Barnahum. And then because of Google, Apple was pushed into putting apps on the iPhone. And then apps became the way people touched the web. Steve Wozniak. People asked me, what Apple product has changed your life the most? There were times when I said the iPhone, but it's definitely the third-party app store. Having that app store let people create apps, and everything we do became apps. Andy Grignan. And then all of a sudden, Facebook and Twitter come online, and the phone started to tickle the part of our brain that wants constant stimulus. All of a sudden, you're standing in line at Safeway, and you tweet to this global audience of people. You can be constantly engaged. Guy Barnahum. Then something amazing happened. The social mobile web of our time, the web that was about conversations, was born. This has absolutely changed the world. Andy Grignan. It was the perfect marriage of services. I would never have predicted any of it. Not a single person did. Guy Barnahum. Apple is the most non-web company in Silicon Valley. They are very product-centric in their DNA. It was really a mistake, almost. Andy Grignan. We always joked that Steve was user number one and the iPhone was built for Steve. He saw it as a way to be productive, to carry less shit around. Ron Johnson. Steve fundamentally guided every hardware design, every software design. His fingerprints were all over everything that was done. These were his products. We were his tools. Steve Wozniak. He made sure every little detail was right for the phone that he himself used. He had a really good mind for elegance and simplicity. That means not having every junky idea any engineer can think of. Steve was really good at turning those things down. Andy Grignan. And the irony here is that Steve never made his own phone calls.
Twitter. Nose ring wearing, tattooed, neck bearded, long haired, punk, hippie misfits. In Silicon Valley, a fortunate few make it into orbit on their first rocket ride. Nolan Bushnell, the two Steves, Jeff and Pierre, Larry and Sergey, Mark Zuckerberg. And that's about it. The reality is that most moonshots fizzle. Take, for example, the launch pad that is serial inventor F. Williams's brain. During the dot-com boom, Williams built Blogger, an easy-to-use web publishing tool. Blogger survived the bust, but not as an independent company. Blogger was swallowed up by Google. Williams's next venture was Odeo, an easy-to-use podcasting tool. Odeo laid an egg. Half of Williams's problem was timing. Odeo was simply years too early. The other half was the people. Odeo featured a cast of characters so shaggy and anarchic as to be virtually unmanageable. Yet in the summer of 2006, those very hairy anarchists hatched a new idea, Twitter. In some ways, it was the least promising idea that Williams had ever backed, but it was exactly right for the time. Twitter hit just as the web was starting to go mobile with the iPhone. And so, while Twitter is another of Silicon Valley's overnight success stories, it took Williams himself well over a decade, an eon on the Valley's timescale, before he tasted the stratosphere. Rabble. Audio came about because Ev and Biz were commuting down to Google. They were living in San Francisco, and they had these commutes, and they were bored, so they listened to podcasts every day. Biz Stone. We were in a car ride home, Ev and Ev was driving his yellow Subaru, and I was like, Ev, I think I have an idea. I think I have a really good idea. And he was like, what is it? And I said, well, you know how we can record our voices in Flash and on a browser and play them back like Audio Blogger? Ev Williams. Noah Glass had this thing called Audio Blogger. He was my neighbor. Noah Glass. It allowed people to call up a telephone number and record a message, and it published it to your blog. Ev Williams. We did a partnership with him, with Audio Blogger, to allow people to call in on the phone, record a message, and get it posted to their blog. Biz Stone. And Ev was like, yeah? I said, couldn't we write software that would sync whatever you recorded to these new things called iPods? Because it seems like they're just getting more and more popular. And so, couldn't we just kind of democratize radio and let everybody have their own radio station? And then Ev made his face that he makes when he thinks an idea is good. He, like, opened his eyes really wide and said, yeah, you could do all that. And so that was Odeo. Ev Williams. We didn't know that other people were talking about the same idea. It turns out that audio distributed to iPods was what podcasting was, and it was starting to get some traction. Like a lot of inventions, the adjacent possible reveals itself, and everybody sees it at the same time and thinks about it. And we told Noah, Noah, you should totally do this. And he was like, that's interesting. Adam Rugel. Audio was interesting. The idea was to be a network where you could consume podcasts. Dom Segola. Back in 2005, there weren't a lot of people podcasting. This is before Apple had even claimed the space. Ev Williams. Unrelated to that, I quit Google fully intending to take some time off, and so I was home every day, and Noah was pursuing this podcasting idea. And he just came over every day because I had agreed to seed fund it, and I had agreed to advise. But it wasn't my startup, it was his. Adam Rugel. So Noah was sort of the true original founder of Odeo, and Rabble was his first engineering hire. And those are two of the most eccentric and interesting guys you will ever meet. Biz Stone. Everybody loved Noah. He was great, big, larger-than-life character. He'll give you a big bear hug and almost crush you to death. He will jump in the water and swim to Alcatraz. He's so strong. He's just a crazy guy, right? And literally, sometimes he's an actual crazy guy. Rabble. In about January of 2005, the guy from TED got a hold of Ev and said, hey, what are you doing? And Ev really wanted to get another invite to go back to TED, and so he said, well, I'm doing this podcasting startup. Ev Williams. And he says, will you launch at TED? And I was like, wow, what a huge opportunity. We can't not do that. And by the way, he also lined up Markov to come write a New York Times story about us. We weren't ready to launch, but we announced, and we did a demo, and it was like a 3-minute talk at TED. But I presented, and I remember getting oohs and ahs from the TED audience. I was like, wow, that's great. Ray McClure. We're still working out of Ev's apartment, and the thing we are working on is getting talked about in the New York Times. Whenever Ev would be a part of something, he would seem to really nail it and make a splash. Ev Williams. It was a big deal, and I was kind of caught up in the excitement. And podcasting was getting all this hype, and I thought, well, I feel committed now. And so I guess I'll work at this company, and this will be my next company. And then it all kind of snowballed uncontrollably. We set out to raise $1 million. It was an unproven market. We had no product. We barely had a team, and we were being offered $5 million.
Biz Stone. Silicon Valley is a crazy place. If you left Google after their IPO to start something, you automatically could get money.